Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Warning: this audio presentation contains graphic details of death, child abuse, and violence. Listener discretion is strongly advised. This is part one of a Dead Souls in the United States series about a proven and real-life organized child abuse and trafficking ring that was both covered up and traced back to significant political and influential individuals within the United States power hierarchy. My name is Jamie Black, and I'm a dark history researcher and psychologist. Tonight's episode is one that my team and I have been sitting on for quite some time. We originally intended to record and release a series about it back in 2023, but we paused that idea and simply released our episode on John Wayne Gacy as a standalone episode at the time. We intended to return to this subject. Then in June, we received an email from a listener to this show from the United States. They told us how they grew up in a suburb of Houston in Texas, although they now live just outside of Los Angeles. While growing up back in the distant and hazy days of the 1970s, something happened within their neighborhood. Something that affected them and a lot of the people who lived in their local area.
The clowning was relaxation for me. I enjoyed entertaining kids. Like some people are, they unwind in different ways, either we're going out drinking or that. I could put on clown makeup and I was relaxed. We would visit different hospitals and entertain the children there. And we didn't entertain them with handcuffs or anything like that. All we used was balloon animals and small toys and stuff like that. But we also did parades. And in the summertime, like on 4th of July, I used to be in 4 parades in one day. I've always told people when I got into clown makeup, I regressed into childhood. It was fun being a clown because you could be yourself or just let yourself go and act a fool. You could be slapstick and funny and have a good time. That's why I always enjoyed clowning.
This is the voice of John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown, as he is known to some, and one of the most prolific serial killers in United States history. In July 2023, we released an episode that detailed his crimes. Episode number 51, if you'd like to go back and refresh your memory. You may recall how he kidnapped, tortured, raped and ultimately murdered 33 young men and boys over a 6-year period from 1972 until he was finally apprehended in December of 1978. Most of the boys he killed were buried in the basement of his Illinois home. Later in this series, we'll be coming back to Gacy, as we are not quite done with his story just yet. But how did Gacy get away with it for 6 whole years? Well, 2 weeks ago, I released an episode in preparation for this series. It was about life in the 1970s and 1980s, and how it was different to what we know and experience today. Some will say it wasn't that different at all. But I touched on nuanced and subtle societal and cultural differences which evidenced how life and the cultural zeitgeist was very different to what we experience now in the 2020s. You see, back in the 1970s, a lot of boys went missing. Many ran away from home, sure. In actual fact, a 2011 Department of Homeland Security research paper evidenced that due to the counterculture at the time and various other societal factors, more than 5 times the amount of teenagers ran away from home than they do on average today. That number was most prevalent amongst teenage boys, by almost twice the number compared to young females. But as well as those that willfully ran away, there were others who were abducted and abused, trafficked, and many more who were murdered. This is not a myth or an urban legend. This is not speculation. We now know just how this happened and was able to happen at that time. John Wayne Gacy was one in a long list of men who preyed on boys across America. He was shrewd and calculated enough to see the loopholes and weaknesses in society and use them to his own nefarious purposes. At the end of the Gacy episode, I touched on the fact that over the years there has been speculation that John Wayne Gacy wasn't a sole perpetrator, that he didn't act alone in his crimes, that he may have been part of a wider network of men committing similar crimes, men who very likely got away with what they did. This subject matter proved to be a rabbit hole once we started researching it. One victim would lead to another. They in turn would link one perpetrator to another. Sick pedophiles hiding in plain sight. These were not a rare or small group of offenders. Indeed, during our research, we spoke to a colleague in the UK who works with ex-offenders, and we asked them how common violent and sexual offences against children actually are. And the response we got was startling.
Significantly common. These are not rare crimes. You would be surprised at how many sex offenders you walk past on a daily basis. And 50 years ago, it was even more common because we knew even less about these sort of crimes, and even less about how to identify them. It simply wasn't discussed or thought about.
But why wasn't it identified at the time? You know when the older generation will say, quote, "Oh, when I was a kid, you could go out all day playing with your friends and not having to worry about any of the things that parents are concerned with today. We had so much more freedom," unquote. Well, essentially that's bullshit. Times weren't safer back then. The data and evidence shows that we as a society were just not as aware of the risks back then. More naive? Possibly. More innocent? Very likely. Let's not forget we didn't have local news cycles, international press on the daily, or the internet. Your world knowledge was centered around your neighborhood and town, and who you learned from were those who you directly interacted with. News was, for the most part, local and smaller in scale. I won't dwell on this too much, as we spoke about the culture in the 1970s and 80s in an episode just 2 weeks ago. But if you're old enough to remember the 1970s, you'll remember things like shag carpets, sideburns, crazy big hair, and wide neckties. You might remember the gas shortages or the power cuts, social change and the hippie counterculture, and the sexual revolution. But for many Americans and Brits, those were the things in the news. American culture was also still very traditional, family-orientated, and good old apple pie. Yes, children played outside unsupervised. They may not have even seen an adult all day. Hitchhiking was commonplace and a social norm. That old cliche that families rarely locked their doors was true. Hell, that's where the cliche came from. That world has completely died now. It's gone forever. And those who never experienced it will likely never be able to comprehend the differences that those of us who were around back then can see. Saying that, the world and society we live in today is the direct response to the cultural aspects of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Have we gone too far in the opposite direction? Maybe. I'll let you assemble your thoughts on that one. The stranger danger message started to emerge in the 1980s, as we started to recognize those issues in our culture that were being ignored or unaddressed in the decade prior. Hitchhiking was a death sentence. Strangers were lurking in the darkness, and too many kids were disappearing. Those we were most at danger from were, in a lot of cases, those that we trusted. Society was not what it seemed, and even the institutions we had always had trust in were hiding secrets within their walls. Places that opportunistic criminals had identified as being sanctuaries for their crimes due to the veil of power that pushed away any suspicion that may be placed in their direction. This was a time when we respected and trusted our institutions, government, and those in positions of power. But evil lurked out there. The criminals were ordinary people with ordinary jobs, often with respectable families, and they contributed to society in a positive way. But it proved to be their ordinariness that allowed them to get away with their crimes for so long, and ultimately, their ordinariness that proved to be the most unnerving of all. And with that, our story begins. Tonight, we are going back to Houston, Texas, the suburb of Pasadena, to be exact. We are going to talk about a man named Dean Corll. He molested and killed 27 boys between 1970 and 1973. For a prolific serial killer, he is often overlooked by true crime enthusiasts and rarely talked about these days. In fact, a lot of people haven't heard of Dean Corll. But what Corll did was almost unfathomable. It was a sweltering hot August in Houston, Texas in 1973, in a neighborhood called The Heights. It's around 5 miles from downtown Houston, and these days it's quite a quirky and fashionable neighborhood with record shops, antique stores, and vintage fashion boutiques. But in 1973, the place was quite different. As neighborhoods go, it didn't really stand out. It was working class, with many blue-collar families and first-time homeowners. But it was nice, and it was safe. It had a reputation back then of being quite laid back and friendly. Welcoming. Chrissy Nelson's family was from that area, and she grew up in the Heights. She was 10 years old back in 1973.
Times were very different then. Back then, your neighbors were all always outside. They all knew each other. You could ride your bicycle around the neighborhood and spend all day in the street or the parks playing with your friends. You could walk with your friends without being worried. And then everything just changed. It changed a lot looking back. I have such sad memories thinking about that time.
The world changed for those who lived in the Heights in 1973. It started with a single phone call one morning. It was August the 8th, and Dean Corll is dead. A police officer responds to a call of a shooting at 2020 Lamar Drive in Pasadena. I wouldn't bother looking it up if I were you. The current owners have made a great effort to remove it from the internet, even going as far as to demolish the actual house in 2023 to replace it with a new building. Though images are still there if you look for them. When the police officer arrived at the scene, he was met by three shaken teenagers. 17-year-old Elmer Wayne Henley, 15-year-old Rhonda Williams, and 19-year-old Tim Curley. There was a .22 caliber gun on the ground next to them. Henley tells the officer that he has just shot Dean Corll inside his home in self-defense. Corll's body, Henley said, was still in the house. The officer was apprehensive, so cuffed the teenagers and insisted that they sit on the curb and didn't move. Now, the night before Henley and Curley had performed a sort of rescue, Rhonda, who had a very tumultuous and difficult relationship with her father, had had another fight with him. It happened a lot. Her home life wasn't great. Her mother died when she was just a baby, and her father was a full-blown alcoholic. He was also physically and emotionally abusive, and Rhonda's relationship with him was at a low point. Rhonda had reached the point where she had had enough, and had packed her bags to leave. She didn't really know where to go, though, so she called Elmer Wayne Henley. Henley had a crush on her, so she figured he would help. He was also aware of how her father treated her. Henley and Curley drove over to her place, picked her up, and got her the hell out of there. Being teenagers, though, their plan only went as far as taking Rhonda to a party at Dean Corll's place. Dean didn't like Rhonda, so she questioned why the boys had taken her there. Dean didn't like any girls, though, so it wasn't personal. But like I said, it's somewhat of a mystery why Henley chose to take Rhonda to Dean's place. But there they were. Now, something internal and mentally within Henley snapped that night. Fast forward, and the three teens were sat handcuffed on the curb outside Corll's house, being questioned by police. The party hadn't lasted long. Police entered the house and discovered Corll's body sprawled in the hallway, naked, buckled, face down against the wall. He had been shot 6 times in the head, shoulder and back. Whilst the body and murder scene wasn't the worst that the inspecting police officer had seen, it was the house that shocked the officer. It was a scene none of them would ever forget, and something that was beyond comprehension at that time. Detective Sidney Smith is the only detective involved in the case who is still alive today. This is what Detective Smith experienced that night. And note, this is the voice of an actor, as Detective Smith didn't wish his voice to be recorded.
In the one, I guess, master bedroom, there were polyethylene plastic sheets and a board with holes drilled in it. There were handcuffs and ropes attached to various sexual devices, and a lot of acrylic spray cans and marijuana laying around.
It was 3 a.m. when the teenager arrived at Cole's house, and Cole was furious that they had brought a girl with them. But when Henley explained that she had argued with her father, and he had beaten her, Cole appeared to calm down and offered them all beer and marijuana.
They were supposedly having a party. There they were doing what we called in those days, bagging, which was sniffing acrylic spray out of a bag to get high. Well, they got so high that they passed out, and when they woke up, they were all tied up or handcuffed, all three of them, including Wayne Henley. The other two, Curly and Williams, had their mouths taped shut so they couldn't talk, and Dean Corll was stood over them naked and trying to have sex with Tim Curly. He then told Henley that he was going to kill him because he had brought a girl to his house and how he had supposedly ruined everything. Henley managed to talk Dean Corll into letting him out of the handcuffs, I guess suggesting that Dean rape and murder Curly while he rape and murder Williams. Dean eventually agreed and released Henley. When he did that, Henley immediately grabbed a pistol and shot Dean Corll dead.
Curly and Williams defended Henley and agreed 100% with his version of events. They told police that Henley had saved their lives. Henley, however, felt that the police didn't buy his tale of what happened. He was sure the police didn't believe the murder was in self-defense. For one, the fatal shots to Dean Corll were in his back. He was seemingly running away from Henley when he was killed. Henley sensed apprehension in the police, so he decided to add some extra details to his story. Henley told police that Dean Corll had told him all about him murdering, raping and torturing young boys from the neighborhood and burying their bodies beneath his boat shed. The police, however, didn't believe Henley's story. It was so far-fetched, they thought. In fact, they believed that Henley was concocting a story to paint Corll as some kind of monster who deserved to be shot so that Henley and his potential accomplices would be let off. Positive members of the community who had rid the place of a deviant. The detectives had heard some stories in their time, but this was crazy, they thought. What grown man would want to rape and torture young boys, let alone kill them? It was simply unheard of. So Henley shared with them names of some of the victims. The detectives checked the names Henley had given them with Houston Central Police Department Juvenile Division. And, as it turned out, the names that Henley had given them were actually listed as missing children or runaways. But Henley wasn't done. He told police that he could show them where the bodies were buried too. Given how the names had checked out, they were willing to give Henley the benefit of the doubt, and both Pasadena and Houston police departments accompanied Henley on a 45-minute drive to a remote location outside the city, to a boat storage facility. The location had rows of metal storage shed placed side by side. Henley pointed to number 11. "In there," he said.
"So we found the boat shed, but it was locked. I got a tire tool out of the car and I broke the hinges off of the galvanized door. Immediately when we opened the door, it smelled really, really bad. Something was definitely dead inside that shed. I mean, I'd smelled that smell before, so at that point, I thought, Henley's right. He's telling the truth. So I believed him."
Elmer Wayne Henley stood in handcuffs outside the storage facility, while Detective Smith began his search of the boat shed, accompanied by several patrol officers. They immediately identified a position on the left side of the boat shed where the ground was cracked and raised up. It looked like it had been recently disturbed, so that's where they chose to start digging. After only around 6 or 8 inches into the ground, they found their first body. It was naked and wrapped in plastic. It had only recently begun decomposition, so it clearly hadn't been there for that long. The officers kept digging and kept finding more and more and more bodies. They were layered on top of one another. Some had been buried for a long time, others were relatively recent. Some, they were nothing but skeletons. What was clear from the varying stages of decomposition was that the bodies had been placed there with regularity over a sustained period of time. Body after body, the police officers were shocked and in sheer disbelief. Reporters had by now heard about the search at the boat shed, and this is where things got even stranger. As you know, by current standards, when a crime scene is identified, the police lock it down so that they can ensure nothing is disturbed and to conduct forensic analysis. But this was in 1973, and that wasn't the case back then in Texas. Reporters were all over the crime scene, inches away from the boat shed, and taking photographs of each grisly discovery. Stranger still was that Henley was outside in handcuffs, completely unguarded by police officers. So he took it upon himself to wander around, talking to the press and discussing the crime in detail, sharing information that the police had not even heard themselves. It was entirely bizarre. Henley, who spotted that one of the members of the press had a car phone, asked them if he could use the phone to call his mother. The phone call was recorded by the surrounding media and was broadcast on the nightly news, becoming the now infamous Elmer Wayne Henley call.
Mama.
Who's this?
It's Wayne.
Yes, this is Mama, baby.
Mama?
Yeah?
I killed Dean.
Wayne?
Ma'am?
Wayne, you didn't.
Yes.
Oh, God. Where are you?
It's all right.
Wayne?
It's all right.
Where are you?
I'm out of his warehouse.
Where?
Out at that warehouse, he keeps.
Can I come out there?
Yes.
No. Is it around the park?
She can't. No, you can't come. I'm with the police, Mama.
The police noted that Henley was incredibly nonchalant and matter-of-fact throughout the whole ordeal, and only showed a minutiae of emotion when he spoke with his own mother. The youngest of the victims that the police discovered was just 9 years old. Another was Wayne Henley's best friend, who he had grown up with. But something was still not adding up to the police. TV stations across Texas and the United States interrupted programming to bring news of the events. Never had a crime like this been seen in the United States of America. The term serial killer was almost entirely unheard of at this time. Although the Netflix series Mindhunter and the 1995 book that it was based on by John E. Douglas and Mark Alshaker would have you believe that the term serial killer was first coined by FBI agent Robert K. Ressler in the late 1970s, the term actually stemmed from historian Robert Eisler, who used the term serial killings in a series of lectures he gave at the Royal Society of Medicine in London in 1948. That said, it did not enter the common vernacular until the 1980s, following the rise of serial killings across the United States, with the likes of Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Richard Ramirez, and so on and on. For the common folks in the Heights, the news of Dean Corll and his victims sent shockwaves through their community. Chrissy Nelson added,
"Everybody was so shocked and upset. But we were all wondering, hey, this person has been missing for a while. Is that what happened to him? And all of a sudden, anybody that was a runaway was a possible victim. That time, there were a lot of kids who left home at a young age, so there was panic and concern everywhere, you know? I remember my own mother going to church and lighting a candle. She was in tears at the news. It was so sad. There was boys from our own street who were missing, boys that I had grown up with.
Within 24 hours, the police had unearthed 17 bodies. But there were still significant questions that needed to be asked. But before we dig even deeper into this crime and motives, let's talk Dean Corll. Who was he? Dean Arnold Corll was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana on December the 24th, 1939. Dean was the elder of two children, both sons, to Mary Robinson and Arnold Corll. His father was extremely strict with his sons and very distant, though his mother was said to be very protective of the boys. Corll's parents got divorced in 1946 following a marriage filled with constant bickering, arguing and fighting. Mary then sold the family home and relocated to a trailer home in Memphis, Tennessee, with both of her sons, Dean and Stanley. Their father, Arnold, was subsequently drafted into the United States Air Force following the divorce. Dean grew up in Tennessee, and after his stint in the Air Force, his father, Arnold, became an electrician and maintained regular contact with the family. In fact, in 1950, his parents married, but once again, this ended in divorce just 3 years later. Corll's mother married a traveling clock salesman named Jake West in 1955. But this marriage too ended in divorce when West suggested to Mary that Dean may have had some homosexual tendencies due to him only appearing to like the company of young men. In 1963, Dean and his mother moved to Houston Heights, where they opened the Corll Candy Company. Dean was a broad-shouldered young man with thick black hair, big black sideburns, and was known to be very friendly and chatty. He was always good with the kids who came by the candy factory, often handed out free candy that his mother had made to the children, pralines, Turkish delights, or pecan logs. He also set up a pool table in the back room of the factory and let the kids play there. He enjoyed giving the local kids ride on his motorcycle and was thought of in the community as like a Boy Scout leader. He wasn't someone that people were scared of. In fact, quite the opposite. He was very popular with the locals. Dean moved into an apartment above the family's candy store in 1962, but his mother had bigger business plans and expanded the family business in 63, starting the Corll Candy Company. That same year, Dean's mother divorced her husband. I guess she couldn't be successful in business and in love, right? Remember that the cause of the divorce was when West suggested to Mary that Dean may have had homosexual tendencies. Well, in fact, just a few months later, one of the teenage male employees who worked at the Corll Candy Company complained to Dean's mother that Dean had made unwanted sexual advances towards him. Mary initially showed sympathy to the boy, then fired him. Between August 1964 and June 1965, Dean was drafted into the United States Army. He served briefly at Fort Hood, Texas, but ultimately was given a hardship discharge after he petitioned that the family business needed him back in Houston. Dean made no secret of the fact that he detested being there and hated the military. It was not for him. Though it was during his service that Dean did realize his sexual identity and accepted his suppressed homosexuality. Close friends of Dean's from the time stated that Dean's mannerism and body language drastically changed when he returned from his military service, and in particular, when he was in the company of teenage boys. It was widely perceived at the time that Dean was an accepting gay man. The Corll Candy Company, with a decision made by Dean, moved to business premises opposite Helms Elementary School in 1965. Dean relished in handing out free candy to the school children. The children loved it just as much. Dean would become known locally as the Candyman and the Pied Piper in the local area. In 1967, following another failed marriage, Dean's mother Mary sells her candy business and moves to Colorado, expecting Dean to follow along with her. Dean was so close to her after all. But he decided to stay in Houston instead, and took a job at the Houston Power and Light Company as a linesman. Dean was, for the first time in his life, completely alone, and this was no doubt his goal. It would be now that something became unleashed in him. Something which had been laying dormant was now awoken. Before we can even get on to Dean Corll's crimes and how he knew Elmer Wayne Henley, we need to first discuss David Brooks. Dean Corll became friends with David Brooks in 1967 when Brooks was just 12 years old and Corll was 28. Brooks was one of the kids that Dean handed out candy to outside of the school gates. Brooks was a thin kid who had long blonde hair and wore thick aviator-style glasses. Brooks quickly became a loyal companion to Dean and would often be found hanging around the back of Dean's candy factory with other local teenage boys who Dean had sweet-talked, pun intended. Brooks often accompanied Dean on trips to various South Texas beaches along with other teenage boys, though it's quite staggering by today's standards why Brooks's parents allowed this. Though, let's once again remember that we are looking at this story through a 1960s and 1970s lens. Brooks was said by the various boys who frequented the candy factory to be Corll's favorite. Brooks later lamented that he grew close to Dean, as Dean was the first person that he ever knew who didn't mock or make fun of his appearance. Whenever Brooks told Dean that he needed cash, Dean gave him what he wanted, no questions asked. Brooks quickly began to see Dean as a father figure. Dean, however, didn't see Brooks as a son-type figure. Upon Dean's urging, a sexual relationship gradually developed between Dean and Brooks. It began in 1969. All the cash, gifts, and trips that Dean had groomed Brooks with had seemingly provided the outcome that Dean had desired all along. Corll gave out cash and further gifts to allow him to perform fellatio on the underage Brooks. This relationship lasted for more than 2.5 years until Brooks was 15, when his parents got divorced and he moved with his mother almost 100 miles away to a small Texan city named Beaumont. Brooks often returned to visit his father in Houston Heights, however, and whenever he visited his father in Houston, he also visited Dean, who allowed him to stay at his apartment if he wished. Eventually, his visits increased in regularity, especially after he dropped out of high school. During Brooks' trips to Houston, he would visit his father less and less over time, devoting almost all of his time to Dean's place. Brooks began regarding Dean's apartment as his second home. So fast forward to August the 8th, 1973. Dean has been shot dead, and Elmer Wayne Henley is assisting the police with the exhumation of body after body after body. By then, 18-year-old David Brooks walks into the Houston Police Department accompanied by his father. He drops a bombshell, one that immediately dashes Henley's version of events. David Brooks said the Corll didn't kill all of those boys alone. Elmer Wayne Henley, Brooks said, was more than a victim. He was a willing participant in the murders. Brooks shared with police that Elmer Henley had sourced the young boys for Dean Corll to torture, rape and murder before the two of them would bury their bodies. Sensing there was still more to this story, the police told Henley what Brooks had shared with them, plus a few minor embellishments to aid in their truth-seeking, of course. With that, Henley started talking. Henley admitted that he had been a willing participant. He participated in the murder of many of the young boys that the police were now digging up. He helped bury them, and David Brooks did as well. Henley did participate in the murders, and he helped strangle the victims, or would sometimes shoot the victims, especially those that put up a struggle. Henley candidly shared with police that one of the victims was one of his best friends, and that he had shot him and thought he was dead, but as it turns out, the initial gunshot had only knocked him out. When he came around, Henley said flippantly, "I just popped him in the other ear." You have to wonder at this point, how the hell did two teenage boys fall under the spell of a pedophile who was killing their friends? Ken Mercer is a local crime historian in Houston, and he has researched the Corll, Henley, and Brooks case for years. Ken had this to say.
Brooks was about 12 when he started coming over to the candy factory. I think he had known the Corll family for a long time, I guess, so he would hang out there. Dean was the first grown man who treated David right. Everyone else kind of bullied David. Dean had a place at the Yorktown Apartments. A lot of single guys lived there. By Houston standards, it was nice. It was there that he brought David, who was this stick-thin, spotty, and nerdy young man who a lot of the kids made fun of because of the way he looked. Dean had given him money. He had bought him a car. He had taken care of him in a way that his own father couldn't do. So when Dean asked Brooks to pull down his pants so he could give him what Texas kids called at the time, a sloppy hummer, David did it. David wasn't gay. David just knew that's what he had to do to keep Dean's affection. A few weeks after that happened, David goes up to the apartment and just walked in as he always did. Inside, he saw Dean having anal sex with two teenage boys who looked back utterly terrified. Dean screamed for David to get the hell out of there, and he did. Later, Dean told David that he shot and killed both of those boys and buried them beneath his boat shed. So Dean went to David and said, "Look, this is what I'm doing. If you can bring me teenage boys, I will pay you $200 per boy." So to maintain Dean's affections, David did. So he began to lure boys into a van, telling them, "Hey, we've got some marijuana." Or, "Hey, we have some beer. Want to come to a party?" In the free-spirited 1970s, if someone your own age offered you free drugs, beer, and a party, sometimes this was all it took to go with them.
One of the teenage boys who David lured into the van was Elmer Wayne Henley, the very boy who would later kill Coral dead. Henley had a pretty shitty childhood. His father was violent, physically abusive, and a full-blown alcoholic. It was Henley who took the brunt of his father's wrath, more so than his three younger brothers. Elmer Wayne Henley, who went by Wayne to his friends and family, eventually fled with his mother and brothers when he was just 14. But what he had endured at the hands of his father would stay with him for years to come. Who knows, maybe that's why Henley was drawn to Coral. It's certainly unclear as to why Coral spared Henley out of all the boys that he had raped and murdered. Dean Coral saw something in him, though, and soon Henley was recruiting boys for him along with David Brooks. Henley, unlike Brooks, brought things a little too close to home. Maybe it was laziness. Maybe it was Henley's sociopathic traits. But Henley chose to bring his own friends to meet Dean Coral and never leave. Homer Garcia, who Henley shared several classes with at school. David Hillegeist lived just down the street from Henley, and they had been friends since elementary school. Mark Scott was a longtime friend who had previously invited Henley to his birthday party. All of these were raped and tortured by Coral, then murdered and buried by Henley. Each of them had parents who drove the streets at night looking for them, put up missing persons posters, and even knocked the doors of the houses on Henley's own street to ask neighbors if they had seen their sons. Henley would tell detectives that he helped Dean because he had feared for his life. Dean had told Henley that he belonged to a United States-wide criminal organization that was based out of Dallas. The organization, Coral stated, traded in young boys, buying and selling them, providing the boys for various services to extremely powerful and wealthy individuals across the country. Henley said that Dean told him this organization was very wealthy and had significant resources at their disposal, and thus would have no trouble in tracking Henley down and killing him and his family too, if anything ever happened to Coral. Coral said that if he didn't check in regularly with the Foundation, and who he called the Dallas Boss, then said boss would send men looking for him, and if law enforcement were notified, then the organization would vanish without a trace. It seems pretty outlandish. Henley did say that he tried to tell his mother early on, but she just would not listen. She was entirely dismissive, he said. Perhaps she didn't believe him, thinking it was the far-fetched product of a boy's imagination running wild. Maybe she didn't want to listen to it in case it was real. Maybe she was just dismissive and didn't have the time for her son that day. We all know teenagers can try on their parents at times. But maybe Henley just didn't even tell her in the first place. This organization that Coral is referring to might sound like a casual and baseless threat, something to keep the boys in check and maintain control over Henley. It might well have been just that, nothing more, nothing less. As if the 17 bodies beneath the boatshed wasn't enough, Henley kept talking. He led the police to another burial site at Lake Sam Rayburn, where 4 more bodies were discovered in various states of decomposition. But he still wasn't done just yet. Henley continued to lead the police along with Brooks this time to yet another location, a third site at High Island Beach on the Bolivar Peninsula, around 79 miles or 127 kilometers southeast from the Heights in Houston. The following day, the two teenagers took the police to the beach again. This is 1973, and the scene at High Island Beach was wild. Bulldozers and diggers dredged High Island Beach on the Bolivar Peninsula. NASA also provided a helicopter with infrared equipment to scan the beach and identify burial locations. It was through that method that the police were able to identify a further 6 more bodies. Ken Mercer shares what he recalls about Brooks and Henley from that time. Quote,
"The beach was a complete circus. It was the 70s, so the beach was completely open to anyone and everyone. There were families out for a day at the beach, photographers trying to capture the dig and reporters firing questions at Brooks and Henley. David Brooks remained very quiet. He was just staring off into space. Wayne Henley, on the other hand, was very talkative. He was just a kid, skinny and small. But he was friendly, so people were friendly back. He would say how they would go out and find boys just walking the streets. They would just ask them if they wanted to go to a party. But when they got there, Dean had a torture board waiting for them. Dean would cuff them to the torture board and molest them. When he got tired of the new victim, they would kill them. Press and police was just a little bit knocked back by how candid Henley was. Like it was no big deal to him. Like he was explaining how to bake a cake."
The details of what Dean Corll did to his victims are not easy to forget. None of the victims had an easy or painless death. 2 of Corll's victims, a pair of 15-year-old boys, were handcuffed together and made to fight until there was only one survivor. The winner would be set free, Dean promised. He lied. The winner, who had to kill for his own survival, was then shot dead. The teens, lured with the promise of a party, would arrive at Corll's and were told that they were one of the first to arrive. More would be coming any minute now. Meanwhile, Dean would disarm them with his charm and offer to show them a neat magic trick. Dean's handcuff magic trick, which he learned, he told his victims, from an old friend. Dean would handcuff himself and then pretend to get out of them through a series of contortions and trickery, when in actual fact he secretly had the key concealed on his person. Then Dean would dare the boys to try it for themselves. That old chestnut. Corll would exclaim, "Now, see if you can escape." They never had a chance. Once they were trapped, Dean took them to the empty bedroom, strapped them to a flat reinforced board, and the torture would begin. In his confession, David Brooks stated that once the boys were on the board, they were as good as dead. No one ever made it back from there. Through all of the shouting and the crying, the screams and the pleading, Corll never relented until they were gone. And then David Brooks and Wayne Henley would dispose of their bodies. They would load the bodies into the back of a van, and they would either drive to one of the select few locations at night to bury them, or they would be placed in a small boat stall. Henley sure wasn't upset about it. He never shed a tear. He showed no emotion towards any of them. The police found the bodies of 27 young men aged between 13 and 20, the largest mass murder in the history of the United States of America at that time. And if Henley hadn't talked himself out of the handcuffs and shot Corll on 8th of August 1973, then who knows how many more victims there would have been. Those who try to find understanding or rationale in Henley and Brooks' actions will often argue that both boys were from single-parent homes. They weren't wealthy. They both wanted father figures and to support their mothers. Dean Corll would provide that father figure, and also $200 per boy would bag them $5,400, which was no small amount in 1973. It's the equivalent of $38,500 today. except for one thing. Dean never paid the boys a penny. He lied and used them too. But how is that all of these boys could just disappear? Why did no one notice? What the hell was going on back then? Well, the simple answer is that a lot of people did notice. The same old answer that times were different back then will only go so far in relation to this case. You see, in time, the medical examiner and law enforcement authorities slowly began to identify the bodies of the victims. What they found was startling to both them and to the wider community. The vast majority of these boys were from the Heights neighborhood, and almost all of them had been reported missing by their families. The police had the reports, and they had just done nothing. 22 of the 27 murdered boys grew up in the Heights. Hell, 11 of them went to the same school. Given that the average high school class size in both the United States and the United Kingdom is around 25 pupils, imagine if almost half of that class suddenly went missing over a few weeks. That's an insanely high number for the police to have done literally nothing about. In fact, when the mother of one of the victims went to her son's high school principal, he commented on the strangeness of it all, yet also did absolutely nothing to help. The families, of course, put up missing persons posters, hired private detectives, and fathers banged down the doors of the police station begging for help. And when former detective Sidney Smith was asked about it all, he had these comments to make about it. Quote,
"There were a lot of kids missing back then, in those days. Look, it was just a different time. Kids went missing and ran away all the time, so much more than they do now. They may stay away from home for a week or two to smoke dope or sniff glue or whatever. It was a completely different era. We looked for them, of course we did. We spoke with their friends and tried to work out where they may have gone. But that's about all you can do. There were thousands of runaway juveniles in Houston alone, let alone all the big towns and cities across the state."
We are going to leave things here for tonight, but we aren't done with Dean Corll, Elmer Wayne Henley, or David Brooks just yet. Remember the Foundation, the Dallas-based organized crime group that Dean Corll threatened Henley with earlier in tonight's show? Well, in the next episode, we reveal the truth of that organization, the men behind it, and what they were part of, and Dean Corll's links to a certain killer clown more than 1,000 miles away. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.